Good morning. A virus that kills 60% of the people it infects between ages 20 and 40. My guest is Dr. Ridenour, and we're talking about the bird flu. We'll get right back to it. I've always wondered, and I guess I really know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it, Doctor. Why Southeast Asia, China? Why do most of the flus seem to begin there?
Well, it's because the people that live there live in close proximity to chickens and pigs. So they have chickens running through the house. They got chickens underneath their houses. They're picking chickens up and carrying them to market. They've got pigs walking around in their yard. So their contact with these infected animals is quite high. Whereas, you know, here, we take our chickens and pack them into these buildings and, you know, and raise them in mass. And it may be that the way that we have the mass market of producing chicken may be our downfall, that this may have actually helped to start the virus. And we were talking before about Ebola and the bird flu. Ebola is not as deadly because of the fact that Ebola doesn't have a reservoir of animals that carry the virus, whereas the bird flu right now, the reservoir is almost every bird on the planet.
Actually, I don't think they even know where the Ebola virus comes from or what brings it around at any given moment, do they?
No, there's multiple variations of it. A lot of it is circumstantial. It popped up about 1976, and they have looked around. They found that the bats will carry it, but nothing else seems to be too interested in it. Whereas going and looking at the avian flu, the viral mass of the avian flu is just so huge that the possibility for mutation is very easy. I mean, that's the way evolution happened, is that you had to get a huge mass of animals for a slight change to happen. Because this viral mass is so huge, Europe just announced that by spring, the avian flu will be endemic in their country. In Europe. In other words, the entire, all of Europe will be saturated with it.
So with that much viral load everywhere, the possibility for a mutation, I'm sure they can do the numbers on it.
Oh, that's why they're saying that this is going to happen, is because the viral load is, it's from, you can start from England and go all the way to Asia. Back to Russians, when it was going through Russia a year or two ago, the Russians came up with a great idea, which is they opened up duck season early to shoot the migratory birds down, which was disastrous. But a lot of places have different ideas on it, and that's the problem with our cultural problems that are holding us back from ever being able to control this thing.
If this happened, if it was coming, if you knew it was coming, and just days away, perhaps, from where you are in Nevada, what would you do, Doctor?
Well, one, I'd have to realize that I wouldn't be able to help or take care of anyone. I wouldn't be able to treat anyone. If they come in coughing blood up and things, they're probably going to die. I would be overwhelmed with the ill and dying. If I packed up and went home, people would come to my house and come out and demand that I try to do something for them, which I would not be able to do. And the only thing I would be able to do is to take my family and go somewhere and ride it out until the worst is over, then try to come back and pick up the pieces.
And that's what you'd do?
That's what I'd have to do, because there's nothing that I could do to help anyone with it. And it's better to try to, survive with your family and ride it out until it's gone by. We were talking before about this, about, telling people that, well, I have a generator and I've got lots of guns and I've got lots of lights and da-da-da-da and all that. When people start talking about how much stuff they have, when the avian flu hits, you painted a target on your back.
Sure.
Because people, when this hits and things go bad, people are going to have no food. They're going to be have no heat, no light, and they see a real bright place down the road. They're going to upgrade their living facility.
I guess it's worth asking you at this point. You would obviously take some medicine for your family, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I take probably some antibiotics, things like that.
What about antivirals?
Probably would stock up, take some Tamiflu, Relenza along. Make sure that I've got everything prepared. I was just during the break just found something that is from CIDRAP again, CIDRAP. And it's very interesting. It's from Montgomery County Health Department, they have something called because we're going to be overwhelmed and things, it's a home health kit. And what it is, it's called the Home Care Influenza Toolkit. And it you can pick this up on the net, and it tells you about how to prevent from being infected, how to prevent transmission between people, and guidelines how to take care of people, at home. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're going to have to do. There is a mask that is approved to wear, which is called a NIOSH, N-I-O-S-H, N95 mask. But even, wrapping something around your face two or three times will probably, a bandana type thing would probably cut down on inhaling the virus.
And so, in other words, it's spread by just the way it is. It's a sneeze, a cough, whatever.
Yeah, by sneezing and coughing, and because it's in the lungs, and the people sneeze and out it goes. We're not sure whether it could be spread by stool or by urine as of yet, but definitely it's a respiratory virus. So. Not inhaling the virus is the best plan.
Why is this bird flu so likely to become airborne, which is, of course, so awful and accounted for the 1918 pandemic, as opposed to through bodily fluids, for example?
Well, this virus, because it's got such a massive infection in the lungs, the human lungs, if you take them out and open them up and lay them out, they will fill a tennis court. And so that's an awful lot of surface area. So that virus is in there, and when you start to cough, it's going to be coming out of those lungs. And it's a very, very small virus, so it spreads well. People sneeze. Some people can get up to 150, 200 mile an hour, 200 mile an hour sneeze.
Wow.
And can actually blow a virus 10 or 15 feet.
Yes, but again, there is a difference between, if you look at AIDS, for example, I believe it is well generally known, it is only spread by bodily fluids, intravenous drug users, that sort of thing, but bodily fluids, right?
It is, because the virus has a very, very tight temperature range, okay? It can only stay very close to 98.6 degrees. So if I had AIDS and I licked a glass and handed it to someone else, before it got to them, the temperature had already been dropping, the virus would be dead. But when it was transmitted from inside of a human to the inside of another human being, the temperature drop never occurred.
What about a sneeze, for example? And this particular bird flu, or maybe we ought to talk about the 1918 variety, I'm sure they've done lots of testing on that. How long does it live?
That's the problem. Current research on this virus under optimal conditions, let's say if it is in a bird dropping and the temperature stays fairly warm, let's say in the mid-60s or 70s, 39 days.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
39 days.
So, I got a little remote-controlled helicopter this summer from, shipped to me from China. I'm opening the box up, and I'm going like, good Lord, I wonder if there's something in here.
A lot of things come from China now, huh?
Oh, yeah. 10% of everything that China ships out goes to Walmart. So, of course, they claim that the virus is not over there, really, because if they had a horrible outbreak of the avian flu, then communism has failed. That communism is not working because they can't control the health of their people.
Actually, I suppose in some ways, communism has a better chance of controlling or isolating an outbreak than we do.
Yeah, they will. Your problem is that you'll have a lot of defections in your military, of people wanting to go home to get to their families, or army units that are going to try to get out of the country by crossing the border into another country. You'll have border wars. They've got a better chance of controlling the population, but at the same time, it's really difficult to control your military because they want to take off.
The 1918 pandemic came in three waves.
It did.
So the world has changed a very great deal since 1918. If we were to make a comparison between what happened then and what is likely to happen in the modern world, how much difference would there be?
Well, that's what they're looking at, is that 1918 was, estimates go from 50 to 100 million died in about a year, and with about maybe 5 or 10% death rate. And so they figure that with the current population and Russia and China, especially China and Asia, have gotten really into, raising chickens and pigs and, really gotten into raising these animals, that's how we come up with the number that the CDC says 100 million. And people like Dr. Osterholm said, worst case scenario will be 1 billion dead.
For most diseases, doctor, people say, forget getting a flu shot. For God's sakes, just eat and live a healthy life and bolster your immune system, and you're not going to get these things. But if I'm reading what you've written correctly, you're saying the people with really hot immune systems are going to be the first to go down.
Yeah, that's, I've received a number of emails today from people who've purchased the book and said, what about selenium? If we take selenium, do you think that would help us to resist this by increasing our immune system?
Right.
And we don't have any research on any of these things about increasing the immune system, but it would tend to make sense that if you upped your immune system, you might have more lung damage than you'd want to anticipate.
Again, it's called what when it attacks your lungs? Some sort of
a cytokine storm. It's a whole cascade of chemicals that the lung tissue releases trying to kill the virus. And it's like an immense allergic reaction. And consequently, it dissolves the lung tissue.
Dissolves the lung tissue.
Right.
So
and so
you,
what happens
you
is that you have cough. In 1918, people came in coughing up blood. They would just basically strap them to the bed and try to get anything to make them comfortable because their oxygen levels would go so low, they would turn a very bluish-black color. Hallucinations. In one account that I read, one man managed to drag him and his bed to a window and go out the window and committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing would happen here is that the high fevers, the heat, high fevers, a cough, shortness of breath, heart rate going up, bleeding, that would be the big signs. A lot of places now, a couple of years ago they talked about it, that if you're coming on an international flight, there are sensors now that check your body temperature, and if you have a fever, they pull you over.
That's fact. When I went to China last time, they, in fact, were doing that. There was a little, I think it was a laser, and they'd hit you with it, and you didn't even know you were being measured. Although I think there was a little sign there.
You're the third person that has told me that, and in fact, in the last 2 months, that they took their, in fact, somebody had their, they did the laser temperature and even took their blood pressure.
Yes, well,
before they got on the plane, and they're saying, "Oh, we have no problems over here."
Well, what happens if you do have a fever?
Well, then you'd go to quarantine until they could figure out what's wrong with you. And you wouldn't make the flight.
Really?
No, you'd be off to quarantine until they could find out what's going on. And the problem is that, for example, Indonesia, if they want to check for the avian flu, the samples most of the time are shipped to Hong Kong because Hong Kong's got the lab that can do the testing.
Right.
For a while in Vietnam, they kept saying, well, the bird flu's not present here and it's not present there, and the testing kit they had was defective. And they got new testing kits and found out the bird flu was in other areas that they did that they thought were clear. So, and the other thing is that once they, you know, let's say that they find a virus and they think it's gone human to human, then you have to pack it in some sort of a bomb-proof, crash-proof container to fly it back to the United States or somewhere to look at it. Because one of the fears is that you're taking this thing on an airplane, the plane goes down, and the virus gets out.
Sure.
So they it is very complicated on how they you know, try to examine this virus.
But, so we have not really managed to isolate and transport a human-to-human version of this virus to, say, the CDC for examination.
No, it's they get to other countries and other countries look at it, and you know, they'll say we don't think maybe their method of analyzing the genetic structures not the way that we do it, and that, so we always tend to get different sort of answers to the problem. Before we were talking about the three waves of flu in 1918. Two of the waves were in 1918 were never reported because the military thought it was bad for morale.
Well, I'm sure it was.
During the war.
Yeah.
You know, and in the meantime, the Germans lost so many people from the flu that they suddenly in late 1918 turned around and looked back to Germany and said, wow, we don't have any recruits. We've lost a whole lot of people that make all the weapons and bullets and things for us. They're gone. We got to find a way of, you know, suing for peace because we're out of the war. So they went ahead with the armistice and then the Treaty of Versailles.
What kind of quarantines do you imagine we would see if we begin to see the real human-to-human transmission? Obviously, the whole world is going to be concerned, and they're going to take pretty draconian steps, I would think, very quickly.
Yeah, I would say that international flights are over. Professional, anywhere where people are gathered together, such as schools, universities, sporting events, like baseball games, football games, all of those things will be gone.
So, in other words, this is pretty important because a lot of us do a lot of world travel. So, you could be in Europe, you could be in Asia, and it would break out somewhere. And you're telling me they would stop all international flights, meaning you'd never get home.
That's a possibility, and a very good possibility. The other thing too is that, you know, we would be, some countries would be forced to shoot down private planes trying to sneak back into the country, or sneak from their country into their country, or sink boats coming in because they've been told not to come in and they're still trying to get, you know, to shore to get away from the infection.
How quickly do you think the infrastructure would break down once that began?
They're talking about, the most experts go 12 to 18 months of intermittent failure of the infrastructure, and that means loss of power, loss of delivery of food, medicines, no jobs. I mean, just unbelievable. I mean, you know, later in a couple of minutes we can talk about my can of bean theory.
Can of beans. All right. Indeed, that coming up. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Here I am, indeed. This is a kind of a rough one to do in a lot of ways because I'm afraid it's quite likely. In fact, inevitable is the word the doctor is using. My guest is Dr. Gary C. Reidenauer, and he's talking about the bird flu. And that's it, inevitable. And the way it will take us is pretty brutal, to say the least. We'll be right back. Reading from Dr. Ridenour's book, it says here, the avian flu is now endemic in Southeast Asia. Now, that means that every summer, which is our winter, the virus will appear again. This year, the World Health Organization states the probability of a pandemic is 30%. There's no doubt it will mutate to a human-to-human form. The only question is when. The virus has mutated human-to-human in Sumatra and Turkey, so those are the countries, but was contained. Once a large country has documented a mutation, the world will quarantine it. No country is going to announce that they have the makings of a pandemic because it will be financial and political suicide. This is from the book Pandemic. By the way, Doctor, where is your book available?
Currently, it's on my website right now called PandemicDirect.com. And I'd like to thank the first 8,000 people that hit the site in the last 5 to 6 days.
Wow.
So I'm getting a good response on it. We're talking about the what countries are going to do when this breaks out. And I had to hold publication of my book for about a month because I had to throw an added page into the back of the book and get it to the publisher, which is that President Bush last year signed the North American Plan for Avian and Pandemic Influenza in Canada and basically has turned over the United States to be managed by the United Nations if the bird flu gets that bad in the United States.
Now, why would he do that?
I have no idea. Everyone's asking it. It was no fanfare in 2006 when he did this, but it sets the stage to militarize the management of the continental health emergencies. It was a shift in policy, but he's going to place the U.S. under international guidelines and not any guidelines determined by domestic agencies. This was sort of a shock to everyone, for the main part is that, my God, the world, the United Nations is in New York City. That's the worst place in the world to be if there's a pandemic.
Right.
I mean, there's not going to be able to run anything. But this is, you can find this on the net, on WorldNet Daily, U.S. under U.N. law in health emergency. And it's pretty scary because so they're just going to turn the whole thing over to the UN. Even the government, our government plan, when you read it also, it's containment, keep the flu from getting to our country. If it gets here, try to keep it from spreading, and then maintain the infrastructure. The bottom line to the plan is you're on your own, folks.
It's not workable. You're saying the infrastructure is going to go down very quickly.
No, there's no plan. The government has no plan to take care of us. We're on our own. Reno, Nevada has a plan that they're going to get 5,000 volunteers so they can get out and vaccinate people. Well, the vaccine's 12 years away.
I was going to say, with what?
With what, yeah. And not only that, they think the vaccine will require one injection and then a booster about 6 or 8 weeks later. Well, who's going to be around to give the booster?
Okay,
because a lot of the people will die before they get the booster.
What's this can of beans?
The can of beans theory?
Yeah.
Well, we're so used today of just going to a store, and you go to pick up your favorite can of beans, and it's not there. And you talk to someone, and they say, no problem, it'll be here tomorrow. And you go back in, and your beans are there.
That's right.
Now, after the flu hits, you have to understand that to get a can of beans, you need a farmer to plant the beans and pick them. And then he needs petroleum gas that's maybe brought from Saudi Arabia and then processed into gasoline so he can drive his tractor. Then gas has to be used by the truck to take it to the factory. The factory has to have ingredients shipped to them. Then you need workers. You need paper cases. People have to go out and cut trees down to make paper. People have to make paste and glue. And then you have a delivery system and an ordering system. And you have to have people that will stock the beans. So right off the bat there, when you pick that can of beans up, there's 8,000 to 10,000 people involved in that can of beans. And you have to have a job, too, to be able to pay for it. With the flu hitting, a lot of those people aren't going to be around anymore. So that can of beans may not be on the you know, in your store again.
And from the time there was a serious outbreak of this bird flu, how quickly would we be looking at the kind of disastrous infrastructure meltdown you're talking about here?
Well, the loss of electrical power would be in the first week or two, and then that would just start the meltdown because...
The first week or two?
A week or two, once the pandemic hits us. For New York City, 4 days without power, the entire subway system is flooded. They pump 30 million gallons, of water out of the subway system a day to keep it dry. And 4 days, the subway system is flooded. 4 days without electrical power in New York, it'll take them a year to put the fires out.
And what do you say to people who say, look, this book, the whole bird flu thing, it's scaremongering. It's just not real.
Well, it's the worst case scenario. The thing of it is that we have to be prepared for it because it has happened before. In my book, so I mentioned that 75,000 years ago, a volcano blew up in Indonesia, and the population of the humans on this planet dropped down to just a few thousand because of about a five-year winter.
Right.
And so it's happened before, and it's going to happen again. And so being prepared for this is what you should be doing. You look at Katrina, and the problem was that no one was prepared for what was going to come.
And nobody's really prepared for this. I mean, how do you prepare for this?
Well, I've taught survival classes, and people go like, what will I need to survive? And the question's very easy. You're sitting in your house, you have no heat, you have no electricity. What are you going to need to survive?
Well, heat, electricity, things you don't have, food.
Yeah, you have no food, electricity. How are you going to survive? Well, you're going to have a food store. You have to have a way of cooking the food and preparing it. You have to have take one small room and get all the blankets and everything in there to make it a sleeping and maybe even a living type area so that you can keep it warm. You have to have battery operated flashlights. A lot of people today have those little, solar-powered lights in their yards.
Yes.
I've played with those, and I can recharge 4 to 6 AA batteries in a 1 day of sunshine.
Oh, sure.
Because they got AAs in them. So I'm basing my electrical power on AA battery lights because I can recharge them without any problems. Mm. And so you need light, you need heat, you need food. You needed some sort of a defense system.
Well, I was about to say, you said earlier that, if you're the one with the solar power, you're the one with the stock of food, somebody's going to come and take it away from you or try to.
Well, that's why you have to be a black hole in the night, okay? In other words, you're there, but no one can see you. I mean, you got the windows covered up and things so that no light gets out there, so it looks like you're not even home.
Mm.
Yeah, that's the problem, is that you just have to hide. I remember one time here we were talking about a flood happening, and we were talking to a couple of our friends that were Mormons, and they said, well, we have all the food. And my friend, the other doctor here in town, said, yeah, but we got all the guns. And they went, yeah, we know that. That seems to be a problem.
You personally, doctor, would you protect yourself with, lethal weapons?
If it got down to it, if it was to save my family, I would be forced. Yes, I would do it. Our problem is that we have so many people in this country that have never even shot a BB gun in their life. My sons went through Scouts. They can throw a tomahawk, a knife, shoot bow and arrow, black powder rifles. Sleep up in the mountains when it's 20 below zero. But unfortunately, most of the U.S. population has no experience like that. And that's
that brings up an interesting question. This virus, would it spread more readily in warm areas than in cold areas? For example, you're up north in Nevada. It's kind of cold up there. Would that slow the spread of it?
Well, it's kind of a toss-up question because in the wintertime when it's cold, people tend to congregate, you know, more in the house, and so they spread the bug between each other. It might be to the disadvantage if you're staying indoors a lot and the family is all going out different places in that, and then bringing the virus back to the house and passing it around. So as in summertime, you'd be better just to kind of just hang outside around the house. Either way, it's the same problem is that social isolation is going to be the answer, whether it's summer or winter. Staying isolated is going to be the big thing.
And you might have to be prepared to stay isolated for not just one wave, but up to three or more.
Three waves or more. One of the reasons that they're talking about this being so possible this year is that the plague was preceded by what was called the Small Ice Age. There were wars during the plague. It came out of Asia. You go back to 1918, there was a war. The 1918 winter was one of the worst winters in history. It froze all the way out to Nantucket Island. In 1918, it snowed in Argentina. In August of this year, it snowed in Argentina. Both the plague and the 1918 were preceded with earthquakes, floods, and all kinds of other horrible things. The same thing has happened. I call it the pandemic parallels. So the parallels are lining up again so that it's, you know, looks like it's going to be a good possibility that we'll have it in the next few years.
Well, something had to have hit you pretty hard for you to write this book. When did it get to you? How did it get to you? When did you realize the danger?
Well, about three years ago, I was with a group of researchers from the University of Arizona who had a medication that they thought might work, and they had some very good connections, and we were going to go to Vietnam to try the experimental medication, so I started really reading up on it and everything. And about 3 days before we were going to go, the Vietnamese government just kind of dropped off the radar screen, and when they reappeared a month later, they said, "Everything's fine here. We have no problem." So we never went. So I continued to follow the progression of the bird flu, and then I started thinking about writing the book. And then it hit me that my mother was an orphan at 3 years of age, and that I'd heard just bits and pieces of the story, and I realized that in 1918, my grandmother and grandfather died from the 1918 bird flu.
Really?
And left my mother as an orphan. And they never talked much about it afterwards, and so I did some researching, and I went, wow, this is really hitting me now because I never got to meet my grandparents.
Doctor, was the 1918 flu the same in this in the storm that would hit the lungs? Is that the same
yes.
way people?
Uh-huh. It was exactly, and that for a long time they didn't understand why it was happening, and when they got to the Inuits up in Alaska and dug them up and got to look at the lung tissue, they went, "Son of a gun, this is the same mechanism."
That's certainly frightening.
It is the it's just amazing that it's coming back again, and the death tolls for 1918, for example, India lost 16 million people in 1 year.
16 million people in 1 year.
1 year, because what their problem was that the doctors that they had were British trained. They were all at the front in the war. Our problem here is that, let's say you're in New York City and you've lost power because of the flu and you've got rioting. You have to get on the telephone and call up Afghanistan and say, "Can I have the New York National Guard back, please?" Because all of our guard and everybody's over, out of the country.
Well, maybe it'll end the Iraq War.
Well, it's going to thin the herd. We know that. That's what it will definitely do, is thin the herd out.
What differences would you draw between H5N1 and, I don't know, how would you designate this new flu, assuming it becomes human-to-human transmission, how would it be designated differently than H5N1?
Okay, H5N1 is our current one. The one in 1918 was H H1N1.
Okay.
And the thing about it was is that this one, the 1918 one, went ripping through the world and suddenly just mutated itself and disappeared. And they think that, unfortunately, this one now, H5N1, is not, doesn't have, won't mutate out and disappear. That it's only has two little point mutations to do to become human to human. So that's the problem, is that it's the structure of the flu virus, and the 1918 very quickly mutated itself into a non-infectious form and disappeared. And they're afraid that this avian flu is not going to do that. It's going to be around.
That's amazing. H1N1 mutated in some way that simply meant that humans don't get it anymore. What about poultry?
No, it just
went away.
It just disappeared. And, you know, they said as fast as it came, it was gone. And so until just recently when we got the tissue from Alaska, no one had ever seen the virus or knew anything about its structure. Once they got the virus and looked at the genetic structure of this virus, they went, this is different than the virus that we're looking at today.
Right.
All viruses do is that they melt into your cell, and then they drop off the genetic message that hijacks a little bit of your DNA and makes your own DNA replicate more virus, exact copies.
I remember the great controversy when they went up north to get those bodies and those samples. Were you against that?
Well, yeah, the you know, I think it's NARPA, the Native American Act about and repatriation of bodies. I don't think it was right to go up and do that. The biggest problem, I think, is that when they got the virus back and said, oh, wow, it's an avian flu virus, about 6 months after that, a German researcher said that they thawed out some frozen chickens that had, you know, died from the flu, and when they thawed them out, the virus was still alive.
Oh my God!
Yeah, and I'm going like, oh my God! They went up and got, that's where they got the live. They didn't. The live virus was still inside of these bodies, and they were frozen, and that's how they got the virus. And now, who else is going to go and try to get some?
Alive after all that time, just in other words, frozen and
happy. They just say, yeah, they'll stay frozen. And that's what the German researchers said. They said, but we went, my God, freezing doesn't kill this stuff, because the theory was that, you know, you cold your chickens and then maybe you could freeze them right away and it would get rid of the virus. Well, it doesn't. You know, you have to destroy the chickens. That's
so the chances fun. This year of it going human to human are roughly 1 in 3, and that would stand for next year and the year after that as well.
It is. And while we're waiting for someone to come up with a virus or a vaccine, then the vaccine will require 12 times the amount of vaccine that we currently can produce, and will have to be available in 2 shots, and we'll only have to order 6 billion doses.
6 billion doses?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so, about the population of the world right now.
It sure is.
All right. Dr. Gary C. Ridenour is my guest. When we get back, we're going to go to the phones and allow you all to ask whatever questions you wish. This certainly is a frightening scenario. The name of the book is Pandemic by Gary C. Ridenour, MD. I'm Art Bell.